From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, the British tabloid The Daily Mirror published a story suggesting that President Bush had, in the spring of 2004, considered bombing the offices of Al Jazeera in Doha, Qatar, and that Tony Blair had to talk the president out of it. It is a huge accusation that the American press really didn't know what to do with. The Mirror story was based on a purported top-secret government document, what some are referring to as a five-page memo. Two men were brought to court this week on charges under Britain's Official Secrets Act having to do with leaking that memo. Those proceedings will pick up again in January. Both the White House, via spokesman Scott McClellan, and Prime Minister Blair have denied and dismissed the charges. A member of Parliament has warned the British press not to publish the memo should they get their paws on it. Joel Campagna is the Committee to Protect Journalists Senior Program Coordinator for the Middle East. Joel, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much.
What's CPJ's position on this incident?
Well, it's clearly a news item that has caused great alarm among media professionals across the globe. And I think both the Bush administration and Blair administration need to set the record straight on what was said or not said at this April 2004 meeting. I think the failure to do so only fuels speculation that the motives of the U.S. military in both Iraq and Afghanistan, where Al Jazeera bureaus were actually struck by the U.S. military, that those attacks were deliberate.
Yeah, you make an interesting point here. This story does not occur in a vacuum because Al Jazeera has been hit, if not necessarily targeted, in the past.
In Iraq, on April 8th of 2003, which was one of the last days of fighting in the war phase of the U.S. invasion, a U.S. air-to-surface missile struck just outside the bureau of Al Jazeera's Baghdad office, killing reporter Tariq Ayub. Now, there's conflicting details about what exactly took place. We know that the strike took place in an area of very heavy fighting that also, according to some journalists from Abu Dhabi television who were nearby, that perhaps a villa used by the Iraqi information minister, Mohammed Saeed Sahaf, had been nearby and perhaps an intended target. On the flip side, we know that Al Jazeera, weeks before the war began, had provided the Pentagon with coordinates of its bureau with the hopes of sparing it from U.S. fire. Another item that is worth mentioning is that moments after the missile strike on the bureau, journalists from Abu Dhabi TV, which was located very close to the Al Jazeera bureau, came under fire from a U.S. tank, which opened fire with small arms fire at journalists who were filming on the roof of the bureau. So again, it's a case that cries out for clarification on the part of the U.S. military. And to date, all we've heard is essentially the explanation that was given the day of the incident, which was that the U.S. military was responding to enemy fire coming from the Al Jazeera bureau, something which has been vehemently denied by Al Jazeera.
When the British Attorney General Oliver Goldsmith invoked the Official Secrets Act and essentially threatened British papers for pursuing this story, some people said, aha, it's a smoking gun. If they're reacting so badly, obviously the memo reflects exactly what the Daily Mirror said it reflects. But the conversation between Blair and Bush also reportedly was about various operational details of the war and sources and methods, details about intelligence gathering and so forth. And I suppose it's entirely possible that no such conversation ever took place, or that the president had just made one of his lame jokes, and that the British government would want to suppress the memo because of the other things from that meeting that it contains.
Well, I mean, certainly one way of shedding light on this would be to release the memo in question. But short of that, I think there is an opportunity for the White House and Tony Blair's office to provide more detail about what took place.
You know, for serious journalists, this is a hard story to cover. It's based on a report of a memo that nobody's actually seen that surfaced in a newspaper that doesn't have the greatest track record for accuracy. And because it's so incendiary a charge and there's so little actual evidence, it just puts the press in a difficult spot. But that aside, let's just say it is determined that the president did in fact suggest to Tony Blair that the coalition bomb Al Jazeera. And let's say he wasn't joking. My God, what then?
I think any time you have a head of state discussing military action against a news organization, that is talking about military action in violation of international humanitarian law, which specifically prohibits the targeting of media, unless, of course, they are used for military purposes, something which would be extremely difficult argument to apply to Al Jazeera.
Joel Campagna is a senior program coordinator for CPJ. Okay, Joel, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
On Wednesday, the Los Angeles Times broke the story that the U.S. military had hired a subcontractor called the Lincoln Group to pay Iraqi newspapers and Iraqi journalists to publish puff pieces written by American troops. The revelations have reignited the debate over the role of psychological operations, or PSYOPs, during wartime and the Pentagon's increasing outsourcing of its propaganda work. But the most questionable doings by the Lincoln Group pale in comparison to the activities of another government subcontractor called the Rendon Group. According to James Bamford, in an article in the current issue of Rolling Stone magazine, the Rendon Group is largely responsible for creating and spreading misinformation used by the White House to justify the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. Bamford writes that in 1991, the CIA paid John Rendon to establish the Iraqi National Congress, a group of Iraqis intent on overthrowing Saddam. After September 11th, the Bush White House relied heavily on the Iraqi National Congress to help supply a compelling case for war. Bamford says Rendon came with a great track record in perception management, having cut his teeth on regime change in Panama.
The way the Rendon Group became the corporation of choice for the CIA and the Pentagon war planners was it had done a very good job in doing a similar activity in Panama around 1990 when the first Bush administration went in to oust Noriega and replace him with a leader by the name of Bandera. They had Rendon come down and basically be his advisor, and he took him all over Europe, introduced him to the Pope. And then he went to Kuwait, where the Kuwaiti government hired him to basically help convince the American public and to a large degree the U.S. government to support the Kuwaiti government in its war to liberate Kuwait from the Iraqi government.
Your piece in Rolling Stone begins with a CIA polygraph examination in 2002 of a supposed Iraqi defector claiming firsthand knowledge of hidden WMD. Now, the man, Adnan Ishan Sayed al-Hadari, flunked the test. He flunked it big time, but his testimony was nonetheless embraced by the Iraqi National Congress and used ultimately as the pretext for war. Now, this is an astonishing story in many ways, but please tell me how the Rendon Group figures into it.
The INC was an entire creation of the Rendon Group. The Rendon Group brought the people together, created the organization, gave it its name, acted as paymaster for the group, helped install the leader of it, Ahmed Chalabi, and then acted as the senior advisor to the INC throughout much of the 1990s, and was their media advisor during much of this time.
Tell me about the journalists who subsequently interviewed al-Hadari and got his message out to the world.
Well, despite the fact that al-Hadari had failed the lie detector test, the INC and Chalabi decided to broadcast these phony charges about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, and they picked two friendly journalists who they knew would tell the story the way they wanted it told. first they turned to Judy Miller for worldwide print exclusive rights, and they turned to this journalist from Australian Broadcasting Corporation, Paul Moran, for the worldwide television rights. And what makes Paul Moran very interesting is, without disclosing it, he had formerly worked for the INC and for the Rendon Group, off and on for a decade or more. When the story was broadcast, it got a huge amount of attention around the world. Judy Miller's article appeared on the front page of the New York Times, and it was the very first story that took the allegations against Saddam from the level of suspicion to the level of actual evidence.
In his response to your piece in Rolling Stone, John Rendon asserted that he traffics only in, quote, timely, truthful, and accurate information. Is that true or is that false?
Well, that's what he says. What the facts show is that Rendon created the INC, put Chalabi in there, advised him during most of the 1990s, and it was the INC who created this pretext for war, basically. You know, whatever the INC did during the 1990s and into the new century, John Rendon has to accept some of that responsibility.
If the U.S. government essentially, through the Rendon Group, created the Iraqi National Congress, and if the Iraqi National Congress disseminated stories about weapons of mass destruction that it knew to be untrue through the New York Times, maybe I'm missing something here, but isn't that an explicit violation of the Smith Act about propaganda to a domestic audience?
Well, I think it's even worse. It's lying to the American public in order to get a war that you want that isn't necessarily based on true information. Despite the CIA's report, when the president went before the United Nations in September of 2002, arguing that they should go to war with Iraq, the U.S. government used that information from al-Hadary as part of its argument. At least a month ago, last time I looked on the White House webpage, that document was still there, still quoting al-Hadary. There's a definite line there between the people who knew that the information was phony, which was the U.S. government, and promoting that information within the United States. And I think that's where you do have a possible violation of that Smith Act.
All right. Well, Jim, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
James Bamford's article, The Man Who Sold the War, is in the current issue of Rolling Stone magazine. The Rendon Group declined to comment to us about Bamford's story.
Coming up, the Weekly Standard turns 10. They grow up so fast. And the gossip columnist who gagged on his gag order.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Advancing the cause of freedom and democracy in the Middle East begins with ensuring the success of a free Iraq.
The president gave a major speech on Wednesday, and TV news reacted. For every story, there's a formula, whether earthquake, missing child, sex scandal, or State of the Union. But this event was none of those. So the anchors reached into their bags and pulled out the mode that fit the best. Campaign reporting. They covered the plan for victory in Iraq as a stump speech. CNN's Soledad O'Brien and John King.
John, is that message that it's working, just give it time? Do you think, as we heard it in this speech today, do you think the public's going to buy it?
Well, it depends which segment of the public we're talking about. There are those.
In the context of the speech, the president's low poll numbers, the timing, and the trappings of his appearance sandwiched between a plan for victory wall motif and a sea of dress blues, politics pulsed and pounded like a rumba. So broadcast and cable danced the campaign Macarena and didn't miss a beat. MSNBC's Chris Matthews took the temperature of the heartland with a seasoned poll.
Governor, thank you for joining us. You know, Pennsylvania is, as I know, a very much a middle-of-the-road state. It's almost a purple state. In fact, the last presidential election last November, 8,000 votes divided the state. It was that close. Right. Where's it going on the war? Where do you feel when you talk to people about where they feel about Iraq?
Well, I think Pennsylvanians, like a lot of Americans, are confused, but there's no question.
ABC's George Stephanopoulos trekked out to Walmart for some Vox Populi, because that's where the Populi go.
So you don't think it's time for the troops to come
no,
home?
No, no, positively not.
How many kids do we have to kill? You think I'm sending my son somewhere else to get killed? No. My
daughter's. And CNN even fact-checked the president's account of a battle, which was actually useful. Embedded Time magazine reporter Michael Ware.
I was with Iraqi units right there on the front line as they were battling with al-Qaeda. They were not leading. They were being led by the U.S. Green Beret Special Forces with them, Green Berets who were following an American plan of attack.
There was the inevitable overnight poll confirming what we already knew, that most people don't like how the war is going but don't like the idea of a deadline. For the media, probably the scariest finding was that only a third of those polled knew anything about the speech. Amazing. With the president pitching, Republicans recoiling, and Democrats dumping all over each other, this week's politics was served piping hot. But two out of three weren't swallowing. The campaign's just starting, and it seems people are already full. Now, a moment of belated birthday wishes for the little neoconservative magazine that could. The Weekly Standard turned 10. It came into being at a time when neoconservatism, which puts a greater emphasis on interventionist foreign policies than more traditional conservative values like small government, was on the outs in Washington. 10 years later, the neocons are pretty much in charge. And so whether those birthday wishes are heartfelt will most likely depend on your affinity for the so-called Bush doctrine of preemptive war. As Peter Carlson wrote 3 months ago in the Washington Post, some left-wingers probably don't read the Weekly Standard because they figure it's a Rupert Murdoch-owned right-wing warmongering magazine. And of course, they've got a point. But, he writes, it's worth noting that the Weekly Standard is a truly excellent right-wing warmongering magazine, no matter what your political persuasion might be. I asked the magazine's editor, Bill Kristol, if he'd seen Carlson's piece.
I think I did, yes.
Did that fill you with a warm and cozy feeling?
It did, both being called excellent and being called right-wing and warmongering. It's high praise all around.
How would you characterize the Weekly Standard in relation to, say, the National Review, which was that other stalwart of conservative publishing, but had rather a different perspective from the neoconservative perspective you had?
Basically, National Review was a representative of the old American conservative movement, Goldwater and Reagan. I think our point of view on foreign policy was more internationalist than interventionist. 3 months after we started, Bob Kagan and I wrote an editorial supporting President Clinton's intervention in Bosnia. I think we lost about a quarter of our subscribers then in December of 95 who, you know, cheerfully wrote in saying they didn't subscribe to the Weekly Standard to get editorials supporting Bill Clinton. So in various ways, I think we're a little different from National Review, a little different from the Wall Street Journal, but we have differences among ourselves, too. I prefer John McCain for president in 2000. Fred Barnes preferred George W. Bush.
Were you going more for maximum readership or readership by people with maximum power? And I use the word more here, so don't say both.
Yeah, I'd say we try to write for, you know, knowledgeable, intelligent readers, the kind of people who will want to read 40, 48 pages a week of pretty, you know, careful attention to politics, pretty highbrow attention to the culture. John Podhoretz gave me a good piece of advice. He was much more experienced in journalism than I was when we started. He said, you know, it's a mistake to think about your audience too much. Put out a magazine that you would like to read. It's a bum's game to kind of always be guessing what the readers will find interesting.
Fair enough, but on the magazine's website, you seem to make a big point of showing how many of Washington's bigwigs receive the Weekly Standard. You note that from the White House to the congressional leadership to the top echelons of Washington's print and broadcast journalists, every important player in the city gets a copy. It seems that your audience is pretty vitally important to the mission.
Yeah, I think so. And also, frankly, that's something advertisers want to hear. So, and it's true. So we're happy to tell them that. But
well, advertisers don't care if they go to members of Congress unless the particular members in Congress are big spenders.
Well, no, because we don't have, since we're small, we don't have much consumer advertising. What we have is advocacy advertising.
Uh-huh.
And if you're making a case for some legislation, you do actually care, of course, that members of Congress get it. So that's actually one reason for that, not to give away too many trade secrets here. Look, but I'm also proud that we've gone from 50,000, our initial circulation, to about 85 or 90,000. It's just gradually grown. And so that means there is a real market out there, people who are actually paying $50 a year for it, who aren't just getting it dropped on their doorstop because they're members of Congress.
Now I want to talk to you about the war. Obviously, you support the U.S. intervention there, but you were plugging regime change in Iraq before the phrase war on terror had ever been uttered by anyone in the White House.
I mean, I think it's well known that we called for, obviously, removing Saddam, and we had a set of pieces on December 1st, 1997. The cover line was Saddam must go, and we had articles actually by Paul Wolfowitz and an editorial by Bob Kagan and me and one or two other pieces urging his removal.
But with the exception of, say, Paul Wolfowitz, your position on Saddam was a fairly lonely one. And wouldn't you say that before 9/11, it was pretty much falling on deaf ears?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we were pretty lonely in foreign policy generally because we wanted to be tougher than Clinton, but we didn't like the Republican Congress, which was quasi-isolationist and uninterested in humanitarian interventions. But it's probably fair to say that we were for the Bush Doctrine before there was a Bush Doctrine. And obviously, you have supported Bush, basically, in his foreign policy since 9/11.
One of the recurring criticisms of the Weekly Standard is that the magazine has frequently drawn a strong connection by dint of mentioning al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein in the same paragraph, in the same sentence, to propagate an idea that's just plain wrong.
Well, we haven't just made allusions. We've made the argument. So if people want to challenge the argument, they should challenge the many thousands of words and documents that we've quoted showing that there were connections between Saddam and al-Qaeda and Saddam and other terrorist groups. We've never said Saddam was responsible for 9/11. And of course, as you pointed out, we were for removing Saddam regardless of those connections before 9/11. And we never made the argument for removing Saddam contingent on any particular, you know, training of some al-Qaeda group or the fact that Zarqawi was in Iraq or anything like that.
Recently, there's been a good deal of reflection on the choice to go to war with Iraq. Are there any second thoughts in the offices of the Weekly Standard?
Sure, we've had second thoughts. You'd have to be an idiot not to rethink things occasionally, and especially when things are tougher than you think or when the war is executed badly. But no, I still strongly believe that the choice was either a victorious Saddam or Saddam being removed, that we made the right choice, and that we will end up being vindicated for having made that choice.
What do you think the world would be like if the Weekly Standard hadn't come along?
Probably pretty similar. I mean, I don't think we should exaggerate the importance of any one media organ. A lot of my conservative friends spent a lot of time exaggerating the importance of liberal media, you know, mainstream media,
mm-hmm.
CBS, ABC, NBC, The New York Times. I always say, look, when the liberal media were dominant, when there was no Fox News, there was no Rush Limbaugh, there was no Weekly Standard, Reagan managed to win two huge election victories and then Bush won in the 80s. When all these things came along, Clinton managed to win in the 90s and Gore won the popular vote. So it strikes me that we all exaggerate probably the importance of these media outlets. I hope we've contributed to an intelligent debate and also at times to a lively and witty and even heated debate. That's part of democracy, too.
Well, Bill Kristol, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bill Kristol has just published a new compilation of his magazine's first 10 years entitled The Weekly Standard, A Reader, 1995 to 2005. While the anniversary has generated high fives in certain sectors, it's also prompted Bronx cheers from other corners, even of the right. Scott McConnell edits a magazine called The American Conservative, which was created 3 years ago specifically to counter the influence of the neocons. He says that 9/11 gave the Weekly Standard traction for a misguided agenda that it had been pushing for years.
I think what they were able to do is take a rather odd idea, which is that in a war against an Islamic fundamentalist terrorist, you should make your first priority to attack a secular dictator. And they went into full agitprop mode, joining Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein at the hip in cartoons, in several paragraphs, you know, almost in any article.
But is there anything wrong in an explicitly political magazine doing agitprop for a position it's held for years and years?
No, there's nothing wrong except that the position is wrong. If the Iraqis had welcomed us with flowers, you know, our magazine would probably be very quiet. But I think it's a kind of a naive political view to think that a white Christian army is going to be welcomed with flowers if it invades any country in the Middle East.
Is your big issue with the Weekly Standard that it's actually been particularly influential?
Well, it kept the neoconservative movement together. Almost any political movement requires somebody to set down the line and set down talking points. And Bill Kristol and the Weekly Standard writers are very good at that. When George Bush and Dick Cheney faced an unprecedented situation after 9/11, the neoconservatives were there with a ready-made plan of what to do, and that plan involved an attack in Iraq.
I can understand how a Fox News channel might successfully steer the national conversation, but a little political opinion magazine?
Well, people who go on TV on the Fox News channel, even if they don't write for the Weekly Standard, read it. So I think they're able to create a mode of argumentation which then can be picked up and amplified, perhaps in slightly simpler form, by Sean Hannity, for instance.
Scott, as somebody who has launched a magazine in order to counter the positions of the Weekly Standard, what do you think would have been different if the Weekly Standard had never come along?
I think neoconservatism within the Republican Party and within the conservative movement would be much quieter and less influential. And I think it might well have, you know, sort of melded into mainstream conservatism. And I think there's some chance that we would not be in a war with Iraq.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Scott McConnell is founder and editor of the American Conservative magazine.
Shortly before Thanksgiving, Time Warner hosted the latest in its series of semi-public newsmaker events. The guest was a real get, the notoriously press-averse Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And many in the invited crowd of nearly 100 business leaders and reporters hoped it would yield a goodie bag of juicy quotes. But moments before the event began, Time Warner Chairman Richard Parsons announced that, well, they'd changed their mind. The event was now off the record and could not be reported. 2 days later, Lloyd Grove, writer of the Lowdown Gossip column for the New York Daily News, wrote an article in which he detailed Scalia's comments in the subjunctive tense, writing of a hypothetical event at which Scalia might have taunted the gathered media by remarking, quote, "The press is the only business not held responsible for its negligence," and might have said about the Gore versus Bush election decision, "What do you expect us to do, turn the case down because it wasn't important enough?" Lloyd Grove joins us now to discuss his journalistic and linguistic defiance. Lloyd, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
Now, before we discuss what you did, tell me what off the record means.
Well, as I understand it, off the record means you can't use it. I guess, arguably, it can inform what you write based on other sources, but in order to have an off-the-record agreement, it must be agreed to by all parties. So if I was sitting in an interview with Dick Parsons and he said, "Can we go off the record?" it would be up to me as the journalist to say, "Yes, Dick, we can," or, "No, Dick, I think we should stay on the record," and then the interview would proceed accordingly. So saying off the record before a large group of people just doesn't wash in my experience.
Well, evidently not, because you certainly decided to ignore it, at least up to a point. In your piece, you wrote what Scalia might have said had he been addressing a hypothetical audience. Did you immediately decide to do that?
I immediately decided I would do this, not as a way to, you know, try and get around Dick Parsons' off-the-record announcement, but really as a way to twit him for it. And in fact, all the quotes I used from Scalia were direct, and I don't think anybody mistook them for being otherwise.
Now, before you joined the New York Daily News as a gossip columnist, you did similar work for the Washington Post. And certainly the Washington journalistic culture puts up with a lot of off-the-record and not-for-attribution nonsense. Every day in official briefings by government officials, who might be the Secretary of State, but you have to read between the lines to figure it out. Before you ever ran into the Scalia situation, had this whole off-the-record thing gnawed at you?
Yeah, and the Washington Post from time to time had tried to make a stand against this nefarious practice. I remember when Ben Bradley was in charge of the paper, they printed a picture alongside a story in which such a briefing was discussed and a high federal official unnamed. And there was a picture of some various officials and Cyrus Vance, who was identified in the caption as a high federal official.
And at the time was Jimmy Carter's Secretary of State.
That's right. And this is sort of something that people roll their eyes about in Washington. Every so often, news organizations make a stand and say they won't attend such briefings. But after a few times of that, everybody reverts to form.
All right, now fair enough. But I have to say, you had another option, and that is, whether Parsons was right or wrong, when he said this is all off the record, you could have gotten up from your seat and just walked out of the room, in effect declaring, I do not care to attend a briefing under these ground rules.
There, I had another option. I could have offered to go to jail to protect my confidential source, Justice Scalia. I mean, I was there covering a public event, and frankly, writing a gossip column 5 days a week, I don't have the luxury of attending events just for my own edification. If I go somewhere, I'm going to write about it. I have to. And if somebody tells me in advance that I can't write about something before I go, and that's the ground rules, then I ain't going.
So on top of everything else that Time Warner did in this event, they were just rude to you because they were stealing your time.
No, they were. In fact, it all worked out rather well, I think.
All right, Lloyd. Well, as always, thank you for joining us.
My great pleasure.
Lloyd Grove writes the Lowdown column in the New York Daily News.
Coming up, a political dust-up over cable a la carte and a film of a future where a media monolith called Google's On rules the news.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters. On our talk with the Associated Press's photo editor on why they use photos snapped by the military, Lanny Carpenter of Olympia, Washington, had this to say, quote, "As for myself, I think it would be far more honest to refuse to use any photo provided by the military. The lack of independent photos is the story. Pull out your copies of Requiem by Foss and Page or Larry Burroughs' Vietnam and have a look. That was photojournalism. The stuff passed on by military handlers is like Cheetos. Lots of fluff, artificially colored and flavored, and very little substance."
And on our discussion about the lack of coverage of the Pakistan earthquake compared to the tsunami, Donna Wood Martin of Dallas suggests a reason we didn't mention. So many tourists, she writes, were affected by that event, Local news outlets all over the world could provide a hometown spin on the coverage. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at things, there were not a lot of tourists in the Himalayas when the earthquake struck. It's not really a matter of America's compassion fatigue as much as it is our seeming inability to relate to impoverished peoples on the other side of the world. We want to hear all your comments. Send them to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
And now an update on the case of former FBI translator Sibel Edmonds, the whistleblower who was fired from the Bureau in 2002. The U.S. Supreme Court decided this week that it will not be hearing her case. To recap, Edmonds charged that she was fired for blowing the whistle on ineptitude and possible espionage at the Bureau. But before a judge could hear her case, the Justice Department declared that a trial would compromise intelligence-gathering methods, invoking the so-called state's secrets privilege. That's the half-century-old legal doctrine allowing the federal government to kill any lawsuit in the name of national security. Edmonds unsuccessfully appealed John Ashcroft's invocation of the state secrets privilege, but because it was apparently super double secret, the D.C. Court of Appeals barred the public from the courtroom when it heard her appeal. For now, it seems those secrets have the protection of law. Someday, perhaps, the High Court will re-examine the underpinnings of the state secrets privilege, regarded by many legal scholars as the product of federal officials trying to avoid embarrassment. Until then, we'll just have to take the government's word for it.
This week, in a congressional hearing devoted to rising indecency on cable and satellite TV, FCC Chairman Kevin Martin sent a shockwave through the very heart of the cable business.
Cable and satellite television offer some great family-oriented choices, but parents cannot subscribe to these channels alone. Rather, they are forced to buy the channels they do not want their families to view in order to obtain the family-friendly channels they desire.
Basically, Martin said that instead of bundling services in variously priced packages, cable should offer most of its channels a la carte. That should please the anti-indecency forces who would prefer to choose which channels come into their homes, but it threatens other channels, including many religious programmers that have long been included in the packages. This odd situation has placed some religious broadcasters in the anti-indecency camp. Complicating matters, some TV stations that double as cable channels face the chilling possibility that the so-called must-carry rules that require cable systems to offer them may be struck down when TV converts to a digital system. Martin's proposal is pretty radical, coming from a conservative, because it turns cable's traditional business model upside down, as Jube Shiver, who's covering the issue for the Los Angeles Times, explains.
Cable providers are like phone companies. They build their network out to try to reach basically everyone. And the cable providers argue that niche programs like the Golf Channel or Black Entertainment Television would not be able to survive economically if they were to be picked on an a la carte basis. They argue that a lot of the variety that you see on cable now would not exist but for the fact that they bundle programs together.
Tell me what must carry means and what its genesis is in the law.
Must-carry provisions were included in the 1992 Cable Act, and they basically require that cable operators carry all of the over-the-air signals of local television stations. And now those usually include the public broadcast station, the network affiliates, and most independents. So religious broadcasters are backing that, those that own stations, because that means there are more religious channels that they can create that will have to be carried by the cable operator.
Well, I'm glad you raised the issue of religious broadcasters, because among those kind of flipping out about Kevin Martin's proposal was the coalition of religious broadcasters, who realized that if people are picking and choosing and paying a la carte for certain channels on their cable systems, their potential audience is apt to go very, very, very steeply downward.
Religious broadcasters have always argued that they want to reach out not to just people who are in the choir, but people who aren't necessarily in the church. And that's why those that have stations want must carry, because they figure if they're part of some basic cable tier, which I think even the people who favor a la carte say that there will be a basic tier of local stations that provide you with local news and weather, and then there will be a point at which you get to select individual programs. Well, if they're on that basic tier that of starting point channels where everybody has them, then they can be among those that you run across when you're channel surfing on your TV. If, on the other hand, we have either a pure a la carte system or we don't have must carry, the audience for that religious program doesn't necessarily expand. They're basically preaching to the choir.
So if I understand it correctly, the religious broadcasters actually have two dogs in this fight. They don't want a la carte because fewer people will opt in to pay for religious channels. And they want to preserve the must-carry rules, which, if preserved, will ensure them of being able to get many more over-the-air religious stations carried on all cable systems.
Yes, that's true. There are two business models among religious broadcasters. There are those who have stations and therefore see this indecency controversy as an opportunity to get the government to pass a law that says all local stations should be carried by cable systems. And then there are those on the other side who just have programs that they sell to cable operators who don't have stations who say, well, if you do that, that leaves less room for us, especially at a time when cable operators, in addition to video programming, are offering high-speed internet access and telephone service. All that takes up space in the cable system. So that means less for the guys that are purely peddling a program, whether they're a religious broadcaster or anyone else, for trying to reach new subscribers.
Considering that the economic model of the industry would be just turned upside down if Chairman Martin gets his way, this thing would most likely end up in the courts. And courts, in looking at legislation and regulation historically, usually insist on the least disruptive remedy. It's hard to imagine that any court would see Chairman Martin's proposal as the least disruptive remedy for the problem of indecent content getting into people's homes.
You're right. The FCC and Chairman Martin certainly face an uphill battle to implement any of these anti-indecency proposals. And of the options, the a la carte one really faces the highest obstacles because the cable industry can argue on technical grounds that it's going to cost them a lot of money to implement a system where people can pick and choose. And on First Amendment grounds, they can argue that basically the government is telling them what programs to offer to consumers. So that's why they're really sort of using the Congress as a bully pulpit to try to encourage the industry to police itself.
Okay, well, Jube, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Jube Shiver is a reporter in the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times.
A headline in the current issue of Wired magazine poses the question, who's afraid of Google? The answer? Everyone. Video, e-commerce, software, telecommunications, wherever media and technology intersect, Google wants to be there. It's the interconnected future of our media, our economy, and our democracy. But is that what we want? The total omni-Googleization, as the French have called it, of our lives? Imagine the future 10 years from now, and the answer is unclear.
It is the best of times. It is the worst of times. In the year 2014, people have access to a breadth and depth of information unimaginable in an earlier age. Everyone contributes in some way. Everyone participates to create a living, breathing mediascape. However, the press, as you know it, has ceased to exist. The Fourth Estate's fortunes have waned. 20th century news organizations are an afterthought, a lonely remnant of a not too distant past.
The voice you hear is that of Matt Thompson, who a year ago co-created an 8-minute internet movie called Epic 2014, which lays out in chronological detail some important internet developments to date, and then imagines a future media landscape dominated by a single, and at least for now, fictional company called Googlezon. Matt Thompson joins me now. Matt, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much, Brooke.
So you created this movie while working at the Poynter Institute for Journalism. Where did the idea come from?
It was me and my friend Robin, who was also working at the Poynter Institute. We took a weekend, went to Miami, and he happened to bring along this speech from the CEO of the New York Times Digital, the kind of opaque, meandering speech. And we were going back and forth on what Martin Nisenholtz, the CEO, actually meant. And in the course of that discussion, we ended up coming up with this idea for what if news looked like this.
And you created a PowerPoint presentation for lectures. And then what happened?
Our audience then was mostly journalists, journalism professors, folks interested in journalism. And more than anything, we wanted to get people thinking about a really different model for what news could look like in the future. And at first, when we were presenting this, journalists were getting scared, but they weren't really taking it very far beyond that. So we mixed the presentation up a little bit and decided to present it as though this future that we imagined had already happened.
Today, in 2014, the New York Times has gone offline. In feeble protest to Google's Onza hegemony, the Times has become a print-only newsletter for the elite and the elderly.
That definitely changed the dynamics of the discussion a little bit. They stopped getting just scared and they actually started to think up solutions.
But then it started filtering out well beyond the journalistic community into the wider world. It became a kind of viral internet phenomenon. You must have been hearing from everyone.
A few months after Robin and I both left Poynter, we just kind of released the thing onto the internet, thinking, hey, a few journalists will pick it up and enjoy it. But it turned out to draw a lot of interest from not just journalists, but Australian medical professionals and software experts and people from privacy fields, people who were concerned about democracy in general. All of them found some sort of a hook to it.
Well, let's get into the nuts and bolts of the movie. You begin with a kind of short history of the internet and its major players. Specifically, you talk about Google, Amazon, TiVo, and Friendster. Could you take them one at a time and briefly explain what it is all of these individual companies' technologies bring to the table?
We used Google mostly because of their search technology. And then for Amazon, the idea that people's recommendations could power a marketplace. We pulled in TiVo partially because of a statistic we heard that almost every person that uses TiVo ends up being won over by it. And Friendster was really the social networking component of it.
2007. Microsoft responds to Google's mounting challenge with NewsBotster, a social news network and participatory journalism platform. NewsBotster ranks and sorts news based on what each user's friends and colleagues are reading and viewing, and it allows everyone to comment on what they see.
That social networking layer we imagined doesn't really exist anywhere in news yet and could have a really potent place.
NewsBotster combines all these evolving technology, and that sets the stage for the big imagined merger in 2008 of Google and Amazon.
Two companies that have been very prescient in how the web has worked. More than anything, honestly, the idea of Google's on as a name probably spurred us on as much as anything else.
And under the Google's on scenario, you imagine that news is gathered and disseminated almost entirely by computer, which, of course, Google News does now.
We did kind of leave in a human element. We did talk about a generation of freelance editors springing up, filtering the content to the tastes of their particular audience.
But I guess not enough of a human element to stave off what you call the news wars of 2010.
We really intended to tell journalists, look, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, all of these companies are playing in the same space that news organizations are. And if it's not until 2010 that we really begin realizing that, then we're out of luck.
The news wars of 2010 are notable for the fact that no actual news organizations take part. Google's on finally checkmates Microsoft with a feature the software giant cannot match. Using a new algorithm, Google's on's computers construct news stories dynamically, stripping sentences and facts from all content sources and recombining them. The computer writes a news story for every user.
It's the fact-stripping robots that work for Google's on that prompt the New York Times to sue the company in 2014, according to your scenario.
Yes. Ultimately, as I imagine it, one of the arguments that Google's lawyers end up making is that what Google is doing is essentially equivalent to what the New York Times does with its sources when it goes out and collects an interview. It's taking information that they freely provide and remixing it and compiling it into a news report. Google is merely taking this information that the New York Times makes publicly available and remixing it, compiling it into another news report.
The movie culminates with the creation of something called Epic. It doesn't sound like a good outcome for journalism.
Part of the thing about Epic is it describes a world that in many ways already exists.
Epic produces a custom content package for each user using his choices, his consumption habits, his interests, his demographics, his social network to shape the product.
If we're talking about a news product that's completely customized to our tastes and preferences, that's already what I have as my news product every day. The first place I go when I turn on my computer is to bloglines.com, where I pull in feeds from all the blogs that I've chosen. And what I've found is that my little news universe that I've made for myself ends up actually being more diverse, covering a broader variety of topics than generally my local newspaper does.
At its best, edited for the savviest readers, Epic is a summary of the world deeper, broader, and more nuanced than anything ever available before. But at its worst, and for too many, Epic is merely a collection of trivia, much of it untrue. All of it narrow, shallow, and sensational.
It sounds to me like you're standing on the fence on whether you think Epic is a good thing or a bad thing.
Definitely. I think Robin and I are both ambivalent about it. It is, like we say at the beginning of the presentation, the best of times and the worst of times.
Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Matt Thompson is a deputy editor of interactive media for that old dinosaur, the Minneapolis Star Tribune.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and this week Rob Christensen, our engineer. We had help from Katie Holt and Kevin Schlottman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.